All right. So good morning, everybody. Welcome to our March 2023 State of the Economy call. We appreciate the time that you are all taking to be here with us. As usual, we have a couple of housekeeping items before we begin. Today's call is scheduled for 45 minutes. Gene is going to kick things off on the call with prepared remarks regarding the state of the economy and financial markets. After those, she's going to use any remaining time to address any questions submitted during the call. If you would like to submit a question, you can do so by sending it to me directly using the chat functionality of Zoom. Nobody else is going to be able to see that question. That's going to be private between you and me. And at the end of the call, I will go ahead and send those questions over to Gene. If we run out of time before we answer your question, or if your question is specific to your particular circumstances, we're going to reach out individually to answer those questions after the call to make sure that you get an answer to those and aren't left hanging. As always, if any questions arise after the call, or if you have any comments or suggestions on how we can improve, we encourage you to reach out directly to your advisor after the call, and they'll pass that information along to us. And so with that, I am going to stop talking and pass things over to Gene.
Thank you, Michael. Everybody should have received a copy of the slides, but I am going to bring them up on my screen so that everybody can see them as well. We will get started. Echoing what Michael said, we're really happy to have you all here on the call. And I'm going to try to go through some of our key themes for this year, and I'll address some of the recent things that we've seen in the market. And as I get started, if you'll bear with me one second, you should see the screens. I just want to... Now you should see my slides and not me. So I'm going to get started. Before I get into the slides, I'll start with page 2. You can see there's some key themes here, both events that are occurring in the market and some of the areas of the market that we think are most important in terms of informing what's happening this year and what our expectations are. Before I go into these topics in more detail, I thought I'd start with just a quick overview of our outlook for this year. I think, you know, unfortunately, the economic and market volatility that were the key themes last year are going to continue this year. We have seen some momentum in the economy at the start of this year. GDP is looking to come in pretty solidly for the first quarter. The consumer remains healthy. The labor market is continuing to outperform expectations, and there's very little sign of weakness there. Business balance sheets are healthy, and that's been very supportive of business investment. And particularly, we're seeing business investment in the area that supports productivity gains, so technology investments and things that are helping businesses to bridge the gap from the worker shortages that we will talk about later. On the flip side, the housing market has clearly weakened. We've seen a decline in demand for goods that's impacting activity in the manufacturing sector. Inflation is still too high, and we think that will keep the Fed in play and raise the risk of a recession. If you asked us at the start of this year about our thoughts on a recession, I think we would have said that if we do have a recession, it would likely occur in the second half, later in the second half of 23, or potentially even at the beginning of 2024. But given the recent troubles in the banking sector, we think that the potential for a recession to occur earlier has risen. But we still do believe that if there is a recession this year, it's likely to be relatively shallow, given some of the strengths that we see in the overall economy that we'll talk about as we go through the slides. As you can see, the very first bullet point on our agenda is the impact of Silicon Valley Bank and the other bank failures that we've seen over the last couple of weeks. If you received our March wealth management dispatch, you'll see a more detailed summary of what happened to these banks and particularly Silicon Valley Bank. So I'm going to make just a few short comments about the underlying problems at those banks, but really spend more time on the impact that those bank failures have had on expectations for monetary policy, interest rates, and the potential impact it could have on economic growth. Just real quickly, a couple of things on the bank failure. And again, I'm going to use Silicon Valley Bank as kind of my proxy for all three banks. I think one of the most important things to note about these recent bank failures is that these were liquidity events and not credit events like we saw during the financial crisis. At the core, the failure of these banks was impacted by, in small part, by rising interest rates, but primarily due to mismanagement of the banks and the lack of oversight by the regional bank regulators. So if we look at Silicon Valley Bank as kind of our proxy, you know, they had a very concentrated exposure to a certain customer type, to a small sector of the market, and did not do a very good job of managing their investment portfolio. So if you look at them, retail deposits at Silicon Valley Bank were less than 10% of overall deposits. The reason that banks like to have retail deposits is they tend to be stickier. Anybody who's had to move their checking account from one bank to another knows that it's not a simple process and it's not something you do very rapidly or very often. So retail deposits are much stickier than commercial deposits. So of those 90% of Silicon Valley's deposits that were commercial, they were also primarily deposits from the technology sector, and more specifically from venture capital, from startup companies in the tech sector. And the other problem with their deposits is that 90% of those deposits were larger than $250,000, which, as we know, is the FDIC and insures up to $250,000 of deposits. So we had very concentrated, a small number of firms were customers of that bank. And I thought this was a great example that I saw. Roku, which everybody's probably familiar with, had $487 million on deposit at Silicon Valley Bank. And that was about 26% of the company's entire cash reserves. So as confidence in the bank declined, these depositors with uninsured deposits began to take money out. And that just led to, you know, an escalation of lack of confidence in the bank and a run on deposits. The mismanagement in the investment portfolio, the company was buying long duration treasuries, which are high quality and great if you hold them to maturity. But with the interest rate increases we saw last year, those securities were actually trading at a mark-to-market loss. So as Silicon Valley Bank had to sell these bonds to raise capital, they were generating losses for the banks. This problem for Silicon Valley in particular was exacerbated by the significant growth in deposits. At the end of 2022, the bank had $175 billion in deposits, and that's up from $61 billion in 2019 and $49 billion in 2018. So they were building a portfolio of treasury bonds at a time when interest rates were historically low and close to zero. So, you know, it should have been, there, you know, most banks have built their investment portfolio over the course of their entire history. Silicon Valley was investing when rates were near zero. So they were increasingly susceptible to increases in interest rates. And as liquidity was drawn down, as I said, they were forced to sell assets at a loss. They didn't have any other opportunities to raise capital. Their stock price was down so much they couldn't raise capital in the equity markets. So they lost all options to do that. And the FDIC took the bank over on March 10th. Over that weekend, the Fed and the FDIC took some actions to shore up the deposits. The FDIC guaranteed all of the depositors in Silicon Valley and the other two banks. And more importantly, the Fed introduced what's called the Bank Term Funding Program. And that's a program which allows all banks, not just these three, to borrow from the Fed for terms up to a year, using their treasury, their U.S. Treasury agency and mortgage-backed bonds as collateral. And the important part of it is the Fed will take in that collateral at par value rather than at the current market value. So what this has done is provided liquidity to the banking system that mitigates the needs for banks to sell high-quality assets at a loss. So that helped to stabilize the banking system. You know, it's important that to note most banks have some issues with losses in their investment portfolio, but most of them take those losses over time, and you see that in their earnings reports. But then it was the nature of Silicon Valley's business and the inability to generate capital that really led to its demise. The banks that are in our portfolio aren't immune to this. They do have some mark-to-market risk in their investment portfolios, but they have multiple sources of liquidity, the ability to generate capital from various areas if necessary. They also have much more diversified customer bases, high retail deposits, and much more diversified revenue streams beyond the traditional deposit taking and lending activity of some of these smaller banks. And then, of course, there is the Fed facility that helps with liquidity. So while these bank failures have an impact that will go forward, we don't think it's an impact or a problem for the banking system as a whole, but it certainly will have some impacts on the economy and lending standards as we go forward. One last comment on the banks before I get into my slides. You know, we recognize that the events that we've just seen are going to lead to discussions of new regulations on banks, and it's really much too early to know what that might look like, but it's certainly something that could impact smaller banks going forward. And from an economic standpoint, we have to remember that small local banks are really important lenders within their communities and really fill a void for small businesses on the local level that some of the larger banks may not always be able to fill. So we hope that whatever legislation comes out recognizes the economic importance on a regional and local level of those banks. So moving on from that, you know, the most immediate impact of the bank failures was a decline in equity prices across the banking sector, a flight to quality trade into bonds, and a repricing of market expectations for the Fed. So with that, I'm going to dig into the slides and talk about that last point, which is on page 3. This graph shows the market expectations for what the Fed is going to do going forward. The green bars are the number of rate hikes that investors expect to happen between now and January of 2024. And the light green line is the implied Fed funds rate given those rate hikes. The number of hikes works off of the left axis and the implied funds rate off of the right. So you can see just prior to the bank failures, the market was looking for more than 4 rate increases by September to take the Fed funds rate to a peak of about 5.5 to 5.75. The market was then expecting to see some decline in interest rates through January, with the Fed funds rate falling to 5.25 or 5.5 by January of 24. If you move on to the right, same data, but this is a look at the expectations following the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. And what you see here is that the market very quickly shifted to believing that the Fed would not only not raise rates, but they would cut rates pretty significantly. The market was expecting 5 to 6 rate cuts through January of 2024 to take the funds rate down to about 3.5 to 3.75. So we had a very dramatic repricing of expectations for the Fed. During the same period, if you were to look in the interest rate markets at the, for instance, the 2-year Treasury note reached a yield of just over 5% prior to the bank failures. And that was really driven by expectations for higher interest rates. By March 15th, that yield had fallen to 3.9%. So a pretty dramatic decline. It's currently just over 4%. So the market is clearly telling us that they expect that we've reached the peak in rates. The Fed, however, has not signaled a shift in monetary policy. But we do expect that the bank failures will lead to tighter financial conditions. Bank lending standards have already been higher throughout this cycle, and they've been tightening over the last 12 to 18 months, and we think that will continue. So it's going to be harder for people to get loans. It's going to be harder for businesses to get loans, and that will have an impact on overall economic growth. And we'll talk a little bit more about those items as we go through the slides. So now we can kind of shift away a little bit from the banking failures and talk about some of the parts of the economy that we want to highlight. So the housing market, moving on to page 4, the housing market is really the first area of the economy that we saw weakness. The chart that you're seeing here is the historical 30-year mortgage rate, and it's based on a 30-year conforming loan for the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, or Freddie Mac, as you might know it. The dotted line that you see, the gray dotted line, is the average 30-year mortgage rate that's been in place beginning in 2000, so the last 23 years, and that rate is 5%. So you can see we've been through more than a decade of historically low mortgage rates, and during the COVID pandemic, it went even lower than those historically low rates. Since that time, mortgage rates have risen pretty dramatically, and they're well above that 5% average that we've seen for the last 23 years. From a historical perspective, they still don't look that bad, but I think for anybody who's looking to take out a mortgage, I think that age is probably the biggest determinant of what level of sticker shock we might have when we see a mortgage rate. Some of us still think 6.5% is not too bad from a historical perspective. But, you know, it's not just the interest rates. It's the combination of higher interest rates and higher prices on the homes that is impacting housing affordability. And housing affordability has gotten worse and worse over the last 12 months, to the point where it's difficult for somebody earning the median income to purchase the median price home. And that, along with tighter lending standards, is really impacting activity in the housing market, which we can see on page 5. On the right, you can see the total existing home sales on an annualized basis. And, you know, we had a pretty large shift up in housing sales during the pandemic. Some of that was driven by people working from home who were suddenly able to live anywhere they wanted to live, not be tied to their office. So we had a lot of migration away from cities and interstate migration during that time period. But since interest rates began to rise, we see activity has really fallen quite dramatically. We had a little bit of a bounce in activity in February, but it's much too early to know whether that is just a blip, a good month for sales for whatever reason, and probably not a trend to significant improvement in the housing market. On the right-hand side of the page, the dark green line is the year-over-year change of the price of the median home. So this gets at what our price is doing. We peaked at the end of 2021 about, and we've seen prices start to come down on a year-over-year basis. And in fact, in February, we actually saw that prices were modestly lower versus where they were a year ago. Kind of offsetting a little bit of that, the gray line that you see is the inventory of existing homes for sale, and that's stated as month supply. And what that means is, at the current activity, at the current pace of buying, how many months will the existing supply last? And that's pretty low. If you look at new housing, you know, you see a similar thing where construction on new housing, particularly single family homes, is lower than we would normally see. So the demand has come down, but supply is also relatively low. And we think that will provide some floor to prices going forward. One other interesting point to note on the prices is that the price changes are really very different depending on where you live. And in fact, if you were to draw a line through the center of the country and look to the west of that center line, prices are down high single digits to double digits in most areas. As an example, San Francisco home prices are down about 10% year over year. If you were to go east of that line through the middle of the country, you would find that home prices are still up significantly year over year in that region. Miami, probably not unexpected, is up 12% year over year, but Buffalo, New York is also up 8.3% year over year. So, you know, somebody's perspective of the state of the housing market is probably very different depending on where you live. But it is clear that slower activity is a drag on overall GDP growth. So while housing activity is slowing, we're seeing very little sign of any slowing in the labor market. And we can start to look at that on page 6. There has been an increase in announced job layoffs. They've primarily come from tech companies, very large tech companies, and particularly companies that saw increased activity during the COVID pandemic years and added significantly to their headcount. So they're getting back to the headcount that they saw in 2019. But outside of those, we're still seeing that supply of labor is lower than demand for labor. And where you really see that is on the left-hand side of page 6. I think we've looked at this chart before, but I think it's so telling of the state of supply and demand in the labor market. This comes from the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, which is referred to as the JOLTS survey. What that shows us is that currently there are 10.8 million job openings in the country, and there are 5.9 million people that are unemployed. So there's 1.9 jobs available for every unemployed individual. Other labor market data that we can look at, like weekly unemployment claims, monthly non-farm payrolls, the unemployment rate, which is at 3.6%, all also confirm the health of the labor market. If you shift over to the right-hand side, I think this is a really interesting chart. This also comes from the JOLTS report. And this tells us of that where those 10.8 million jobs are, the job openings. So you can see in some sectors, there's less information, financials, some of the other services. There are job openings, but they're not as significant as in some of the other sectors. You know, we've talked about in the past, the leisure and hospitality sector and the trouble that businesses have had in rehiring people as they reopened coming out of the pandemic. And you see that there. Interestingly, you know, education and healthcare has more than 2 million job openings. We know that there are teacher shortages in many states, and we've seen estimates in the healthcare industry that more than 100,000 nurses left their jobs during COVID and did not return. So that's having an impact on the health and the ability to service patients in the healthcare system. In the government category, the shortages are primarily at the state and local level. But this is a good snapshot of there's still pretty strong demand across a broad base of the economy for labor and not enough people skilled enough or willing to take these jobs. So the problem with the imbalance is that imbalances in the labor market are leading to higher inflation, higher wage inflation, and wage inflation is stickier. It tends to last longer once it gets into the system. And it's one of the things that's making a little bit more difficult for the Fed to get inflation back under control. We're actually going to start with the graph on the right-hand side of the page, which is the year-over-year change in wages across the economy as calculated by the Atlanta Fed. You can see we've come down a little bit from the peak. This data is through February, and wages are up 6.1% year over year. Notably, the consumer price index, which we'll look at in a few pages, was up 6% year over year, just below the wage gains. But clearly, wage inflation has a long way to go to get back to something that's more sustainable for the Fed. The graph on the left shows the total household debt as a percentage of disposable income. This measure of household debt includes mortgages, auto loans, credit cards, and other types of consumer loans. And the reason it's important is we've often seen headlines and you hear people talking about the increased use of consumer credit and the rise in credit card debt. which has been rising, and it's something that's worth paying attention to. But looking at the debt service that individuals have relative to their disposable income, we think is a better way of really measuring the health of the consumer. And you can see that household debt service as a percentage of disposable income has risen recently, and it's at 9.7%, but it's still at a manageable level and probably helps to explain why we're seeing pretty moderate or surprisingly decent consumer spending in the first quarter of this year. So over the next couple of pages, we'll take a deeper dive into inflation. Starting on page 8, this graph shows two kind of narrow measures of inflation. The gray line is the core personal consumption expenditures price index, or core PCE is how it's referred to. And the green line is the core consumer services price index, excluding housing, which is referred to as super core inflation. You may wonder, why do we want to use very narrow definitions of inflation? And there's really two reasons. One, the Fed has told us that these are two of their favorite measures of inflation. So paying attention to what's happening and the trends in these two series gives us some insight into future monetary policy changes. And the other thing is, core inflation measures are meant to take out the month-to-month noise and really focus on trends. And they were important when we saw inflation moving higher to figure out, you know, are we trending up and where? And as inflation is coming back down, we also want to see where the overall trend is without looking at month-to-month shifts. The super core inflation, which Chairman Powell really seems to like, as I mentioned, excludes housing-related factors. And the importance that he has mentioned for that is that changes to housing costs come into the inflation, broader inflation measures with a lag, and they leave the inflation measures with a lag. So we have seen, as we just talked about, that home prices are starting to come down. We're seeing anecdotal evidence that rents are coming down, but the broader measures of inflation are not picking that up yet. So this gives us a little bit of a different look. You know, these measures, both of them, they reached a peak last fall. They've come down a little bit, but they've kind of stalled out a bit. And I think this might help explain why the Fed was willing to raise interest rates by 25 basis points last week, despite the fact that they had uncertainty in the banking sector. The next page takes a little closer look at broader inflation, the consumer price index, and what's improving and what's not improving. So here, the first data, the February 2023, all of these are year over year changes. So the overall CPI index is up 6% year over year through February. The column to the right of that shows what the year over year change was at the peak, if we've reached a peak. And the last column shows the date that we reached a peak in those different series. So overall CPI peaked actually in June, that's my typo in there, in June of 2022 at 9.1% and has since fallen to 6%. If you look at some of these details here in the top half, you know, food inflation is still high, but it is coming down from its peak. Energy inflation is also coming down from its peak. And in fact, energy commodity prices are actually down slightly year over year. That's a volatile component, so we don't expect that trend to necessarily continue. It could bounce around, but we're seeing some improvement. If you move to the bottom part of the page to core CPI components, particularly core goods, you can see that peaked in February of 2022. And now in February of this year, it's up just 1% year over year. So significant movement from the peak. And you can see some of the factors, including, you know, in the past, we've talked about new vehicles and used vehicles and the prices there surging during COVID. So there is improvement there. The last section, core services, we don't know that we've seen a peak there. We're at the high levels and we're still watching that data. So we're seeing good signs that inflation is improving, but we're not done yet, and the Fed is probably not done yet. To wrap up the inflation discussion, we're going to move to page 10 in inflation expectations. If you remember, expectations are really important because future expectations of inflation really drive both consumer and business buying decisions. So again, we've seen significant improvement. This data comes from a New York Fed survey showing us in the gray line that the expectations are that for inflation to fall to 2.7% over the next 3 years and 4.2% in the next year. So again, we're getting the expectations down, which should help consumers and businesses feel comfortable to continue spending. So, you know, the big thing that all of these inflation drivers are impacting is Fed activity. And so we're going to move on to page 11 and talk about Fed policy, which has become a little bifurcated in the last couple of weeks. And I'll explain that. You know, we talk about the Fed's dual mandate, which is price stability and full employment. But the Fed also has a very important responsibility of making sure that the financial system is stable. So the recent problems in the banking sector have kind of shifted and created this bifurcation. Last week, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed raised the funds rate by 25 basis points to a range of 4.75% to 5%. And you can see that on the chart on the left-hand side of the page. But the Fed is also using its balance sheet to provide liquidity to the financial system. So the graph on the right is really where we've seen a change. This shows the size of the Fed's balance sheet. We have been since May of last year in a period where the balance sheet has been shrinking. The Fed hasn't been selling assets, but they've been not replacing maturities or reinvesting coupon payments. So the balance sheet has been shrinking more recently by about $95 billion a month. Since that peak in May of 2022, the balance sheet has fallen from $8.9 trillion to about $8.3 trillion. However, if you're looking at the graph, you can see a little tick up, and that occurred in the last 2 weeks with the Fed's announcement of the liquidity facility to aid the banking sector. The balance sheet has actually increased back up to 8.6. So the Fed hasn't made any change to its balance sheet runoff policy, but they have been very clear that they're willing to use the balance sheet to make sure that the banking system stays stable. So we expect that Chair Powell in his commentary last week talked about using interest rates to manage inflation and using the balance sheet to provide stability in the financial system. And so that's why we say that these two tools, these two primary tools that the Fed has, may be moving in different directions for a little bit. We do believe on the interest rate side that we're kind of at the beginning of the end of the tightening cycle. There may still be a couple of rate hikes needed to get inflation under control, but the bulk of the move is behind us. And the recent bank failures are probably going to help that process. They could almost be considered as additional rate hikes because they're likely to lead to tightening financial conditions and certainly some other deflationary pressures. The one other thing I'd say about the Fed is that we still believe there's a pretty high bar for future rate cuts. The market thinks that the Fed's going to cut rates. We tend to think that Chairman Powell and the rest of the Fed has told us repeatedly that they're very concerned about reaccelerating inflation like we saw in the 1970s. So we do take them at their word that they're going to get to a terminal rate and leave it there for longer in order to make sure that we don't have a reacceleration. I'm going to skip page 12. It just shows some changes in interest rates, but in the interest of time, I'm going to move on to page 13. And talk about both the fixed income and the equity market and the opportunities that we see there, given the disruptions that we've seen over the last 12 or 18 months. So the first page you have here, you know, 2022 was a very unusual year in that both stocks and bonds had negative returns. Bond returns bond prices move opposite of yields. And as the Fed is raising rates, that pushed bond prices down. The longer the maturity of your bond, the more that impacted your return. And if you look at a broad measure of investment grade corporate bonds of all types, treasuries, agencies, et cetera, they were down about 13% last year. Shorter bonds did better than longer bonds, but overall we had, an unusual year in the bond market, but that's created a great opportunity. The chart that you see here is the yield to maturity of an investment grade corporate bond that is set to mature in the next 1 to 5 years. And you can see that those yields have risen dramatically. Over the last couple of years, we've talked a lot about fixed income being a diversifier, but not providing incremental income. After last year, we're now in a situation where bonds can be a diversifier and bonds can provide attractive incremental income and returns going forward. So, a high quality bond, which is what this would be a proxy for, would be yielding somewhere between 4% and 5%, depending on the credit rating and the maturity of your bond. So if you buy these bonds, hold them to maturity, you can expect a solid income stream over the next several years. We don't think that now is the time to take more credit risk in the fixed income market or to take more maturity risk, but we think this opportunity in high quality bonds is really good for the first time in many, many years. Chris Leslie, our portfolio manager, has actually did a really nice write-up in our March Wealth Management Dispatch talking about this opportunity in bonds. And so the last page looks at the equity market opportunities. And I thought I'd do it by talking about what's worked and not worked in the market over several time periods. So the chart you see here are the returns of the S&P 500 and the broad sectors of the market year to date for the trailing 12 months. And all of this data is through last Friday. And then the 3 years ending last Friday. The main reason we included the 3-year returns is I think that sometimes we get caught up in the day-to-day, and I think it's important to look at a longer term and put the volatility that we've seen in perspective. The S&P is still up 22.7% annually for the 3 years that ended last week. So still good returns in the market. In that type of strong market, as you would expect, some of the outperforming sectors are some of the more cyclical things like technology, which performed quite well, industrials, defensive sectors in that type of market environment, you would expect to not do as well, but they still did provide significant positive returns for those 3-year periods. Even if you look at, say, utilities, and these are the dark green bars, the utility sector was up 16% annually for that 3-year period. Moving to the 1-year total returns, for the last year, the trailing 12 months, the S&P is down 11%. And the energy sector is the only sector of the market that provided positive returns. Interest rate sensitive sectors like real estate really underperformed. Consumer discretionary, communications, underperformed during that time period. But also the defensive sectors didn't provide as much defense as you would have thought. Utilities are down during that time period as well. And then finally, the year to date, which is the light green, the market is up marginally year to date, but the returns across sectors are very different. We've seen to start this year that the more cyclical, the higher growth companies have outperformed, and that really shows up in the technology. The communications sector is really driven by Facebook, which is up something like 60% year to date. This is not what we would expect to see in an environment with heightened volatility, both economic and market, but it is what has been happening this year. So when we look at all of these different iterations, I think what we're looking at is, given the economic uncertainty, we still want to remain defensive, but we think there's some good opportunities in some of these more defensive sectors that have underperformed. for us to find good quality companies that can provide long-term benefit to our portfolio. We have some companies in our income equity portfolio that did quite well last year that really don't provide the same income opportunity as they did when we purchased them. So we're going to take a look at maybe upgrading the yield and the opportunities there. And we think in the growth portfolio, there's also going to be opportunities to upgrade the potential growth characteristics of that portfolio while still staying defensive overall. From a sector basis, you know, energy has done quite well. We still think there is a long-term positive trend in the energy sector, but you need to be selective in your names. And I think the same would be the case for the technology sector. There's still good long-term upside to that sector, but you want to be very selective. Real estate has underperformed, is one of the worst performing sectors, but we don't think now is the time to be investing in real estate, given some of the concerns we have within those sectors, particularly with commercial real estate. But the main point we want to make in all of this is market dislocations create opportunities, and we expect to make some changes to the portfolios going forward that will take advantage of these. So with that, I think I'll just give you a couple of key takeaways broadly. You know, parts of the economy are weakening, housing and manufacturing, but the labor market, corporations, and the consumer balance sheets remain healthy and could support growth going forward. Inflation is receding, but there's still some work to be done, particularly in the service area and wages. We think the Fed will remain active and hold rates at a higher level for longer in order to be certain that they can get inflation to a level that doesn't impact decision making, and more importantly, that they can get rates to a level where they can hold them and not risk reaccelerating inflation. Outside of the topics we've covered, you know, we certainly recognize there's a lot of other areas of volatility this year. We have a debt ceiling debate coming up that's going to be quite ugly in the short run, but we believe it will be resolved. There are still lingering questions in the banking sector. We think overall the banking sector is healthy and the Fed has taken the right moves to support stability, but that's likely to cause volatility. And, you know, the ongoing war in Ukraine is certainly disruptive on many levels. We expect to stay defensive, but we think there are some opportunities for us to make changes in the portfolio, and you should see those going forward. And finally, fixed income is as attractive as it has been in more than a decade, and certainly should be considered as part of a balanced portfolio. So with that, I will turn it back over to Michael.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Jean. You must have done a pretty good job because we have zero questions today, which works out well because we're also out of time. Again, any questions that have come up after the call, comments, suggestions, we're always happy to hear those. We want to do the best job we possibly can for each and every one of our clients. So we hope to hear from at least some of you with some feedback here. And aside from that, I think that's it. So thank you all again for attending, and we will hopefully talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone.